Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community.
Greetings, Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I'm a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. Today's conversation is with Bobby Morgan. Bobby is passionate about education and started his career teaching math in Camden, New Jersey, which was voted one of the most dangerous cities to live in. The students taught him a lot. He is now an assistant principal in New Jersey's Willingboro Township School District outside of Philadelphia. As a school district board member, he gains further insight into the inner workings and challenges school districts face. Additionally, Bobby is a speaker and consultant who builds disruptive educators through culturally responsive teaching, social justice education, and restorative practices. Much of this work is publicly expressed through the Liberation Lab podcast. I first connected with Bobby through Instagram, where he was asking questions I had not considered. Anytime I can talk with someone who challenges me to ask new questions, I win, and I'm bringing him on here to this conversation so we all win. Bobby, welcome to Curated Questions.
Honored to be here, Ken. Thank you so much for that introduction. I'm honored to have this conversation with you.
Excellent. Good to have you here. Watching your work as you're asking the questions and engaging the world, I was excited to start to develop that connection through social media. So it's good to have you here. To introduce folks to your early career, what did those kids in Camden teach you?
Yeah, much like you stated, I came in with a preconceived notion of who those kids would be and what they would need. Imagine like the already prepped Lunchables that we used to have at lunch, right? It's already packaged. It's already there. But what if you're in a mood for something different? There's no customization. You get what you get in the package. That is how I showed up to my students. I was already a prepackaged meal, if you will, that did not customize to what they needed and what would best support them. So I came in with very high control. I assumed that if I didn't do my job, they were going to act up, that they didn't show up to learn and to grow, which is the furthest thing from the truth. Those were some of the most brilliant minds that I've ever had the honor of teaching. So I bought into the stereotypes. I bought into the single story narratives that I told myself about those students. And they taught me not to buy into any single story narrative. They taught me that if I'm going to be a better educator, I got to ask better questions of myself and of my students. And if I'm going to truly teach, then I don't show up with a preconceived notion of who my students are. I ask questions and allow them to give me the answers and they can show me who they are and I can better meet their needs.
What did that look like for them to do that? What's a practical example of something that happened and you kind of took a step back in those early days of going, dang, I got something to learn here, or that first understanding that you were bringing that Lunchable to bear and that was not necessarily the right perspective?
I think of a seventh grade student. We'll call him Thomas for now. Mm-hmm. Thomas was a seventh grader. I actually taught eighth grade math. And my colleague was literally next door teaching seventh grade math. We were all on the same floor of this old Catholic school building. So I kind of went next door and I would kind of help her teach. She'd come over and help me teach. It was kind of like our thing. And when I was trying to assist, in my mind, help this kid, Thomas, we butt heads. He did not like me for whatever reason, it seemed. So I go into what I know. No, you are going to do this. I do expect you to, like, I am going to meet force with force. So fast forward that story to make a long story longer. I asked his math teacher to arrange a meeting with his parents so we could talk about things. And I was going to say, you know, he was disrespectful. All things that teachers say now, right? It's disrespectful, defiant, and disruptive. It's the three D's. And when you ask teachers this, when you ask them, what does that really mean? It typically means that the student didn't show up in a way that met my sensibilities. Because they did something outside of what I expected them to do, I'm going to categorize it as defiant, disrespectful, and disruptive. And I fell right into that. So I'm sitting there talking to him and his mother, and the mom, in tears, turns to him and says, "I can't make it out of Camden, but you can." Tears in her eyes, bawling, and says, "Please just listen to your teacher." But what the mom was letting me know is she is doing all she can to support this her son. She's working hard, and she feels trapped because what we don't typically do in education is recognize or get curious about the fact that zip code is one of the biggest determining factors to what kind of education a student will receive, what kind of opportunity that student will receive. And so this mother clued me in on that very quickly because she felt trapped to a location. I've never felt trapped in a location. Like, yes, I grew up in places, and yes, we moved occasionally, but I never felt trapped where I was at. That wasn't my reality.
Right.
So when she let me know that, it gave me context for where the student was at. It gave me empathy, because I think what happens, and this is something that I think we'll get into later in the conversation, and I'll wrap it up here by saying, when we ask better questions of each other, we gain proximity. Proximity is something that is sorely needed in our world, because we would rather shout in our silos and create distance from each other. And when we create that distance, now I can vilify you because I don't understand you.
We're certainly seeing evidence across in the greater world, talk the political or any particular topic that comes up, to your point. Yeah. So how did that work with Thomas and you being able to take that next step to have kind of that, I'm assuming, some kind of a breakthrough, some kind of a connection where things did change, or maybe they didn't. I don't know how the rest of the story pans out, but where did it go from there? Where did the relationship go from there?
I would love to say that it was roses after that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's actually appropriate. There were moments where it was great, because my next move, and not move in terms of manipulation, but the next way forward for me would have been, and I did, was to apologize. To let Thomas know that my approach with him wasn't consistent with the student that he is. It was consistent with the student I thought he was. To let him know that I had it wrong, and I hope he would give me the opportunity to make it right. So we had that conversation. We shook hands. And I would love to say that it all went well, because here's the thing that I quickly realized as well. Once I started the process of unlearning these harmful practices and behaviors that I was engaged in, it was like being an oasis in a desert. Because the systems and the policies and the procedures of the school still operated in a way that these harmful actions played out. I'll give you an example. Silent transitions. When a kid goes from class to class, it is 100% silent in the hallway. You line up, you stay in your line, you go to your class, you come in, you're in your seat within 30 seconds. And then we get mad at the kid not talking in class, but we told them that their voice doesn't belong in the school. So while I would laugh and joke and invite them to bring their full humanity to class, it was still operating within a system that did not welcome it. I would love to say that everything worked out well now that I realized it, but sometimes you can't self-care your way out of broken systems. You got to get it to the systems level and really do work there, which is why I'm proud of the work that I get to do with Liberation Lab, is seeing that the experience with Thomas and other students led me to see where the root of these things happen. And I get to do that work as well. As far as Thomas goes, even though we had a thorny, I guess you go back to the Rose analogy, kind of existence together, he got to see me apologize. He got to see me care. He got to see me come back to the table, ask for forgiveness, and really try to make things work. I would love to say that he is this success story. I literally found out this past week that a year or two into his high school career, he was a victim of gun violence and was no longer with us. Yeah.
Man. Sorry for that loss.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about it because it's not like it happened so long ago, but when I heard it, it hurt like it was yesterday. Like it just happened.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's now for you, right? The news is now.
Yeah.
So to think of the statistics for specifically the students in Camden or in some of these other tougher neighborhoods, just the amount of stories of trauma, pain at every level, anyway, that seems like the good news stories are very far and few between. And there's just so much to come through at every level for those that are living in those circumstances.
Yeah. And I think part of that is it's intentional, right? Like the good news stories are kept from us. They don't sell as much as hearing news of pain or harm. The countless stories that I could tell you of teachers who have gone in with the best of intentions and seen great outcomes, doctors, lawyers who have come from Camden, programs and initiatives that have changed families' trajectories. All of that is present in places like Camden. So I'm in Jersey, in New Jersey, for those who are listening. And the big three, if you will, of places where you see these narratives show up is places like Newark, New Jersey, Trenton, New Jersey, and Camden. That is literally going from north to south. There are other places, but those are the big three that you hear of pretty often. And I think it's because part of it is this single narrative that we continue to tell ourselves. The news is framed under the single narrative. So when you hear stories, you hear about the harm and the trauma and those things. And here's the thing. If I tell you about the circumstances and the plot surrounding these areas, but I never tell you about the true villain that's behind it, you blame the people who are experiencing. So we blame the folks of Trenton for the conditions that they find themselves in. And that's not to say that there is no human responsibility. There's always a responsibility on us, despite the hand that we are given, to be able to make the most out of what we have, right?
Absolutely.
That is absolutely true. At the same time, when we talk about the quote unquote hood, that's not an accident. That is an intentional act of our government to pull resources and opportunity from a group of people and then blame them for the results of that. I think asking questions of our history helps us make better sense of our present. Because we're not asking those questions, we then create our own narratives that teach us lies about groups of people, and we misunderstand each other and miss each other in the process.
I watched Origin last night, which is based on the book Cast by Isabel Wilkinson. And I so much love her work. I was freshly reminded of the caste system that we have in America and what that looks like. So it should not be any surprise for where we have built a system and we continue to reinforce that system for the results that we get from that system. It's like, oh, well, yeah, well, we did this. Yeah.
And knowing that should give us context for how we view each other. We see trauma manifest, a greater respect for what others have been through, what success looks like for them, what measures of success we have. It should cause us to be curious about what, quote, the American dream looks like when you factor in these other things at play. Because perhaps the 2.5 kids, the white picket fence, and the dog isn't the reality for everybody because of where our starting points have been. And perhaps it's not a dream for some people. It's a nightmare because of the ways in which our government, our history, our choices, our bias. And let me say this for anybody listening. That is not me saying that you, any person who's listening who happens to be racialized as white, is solely the person who is on the receiving end of bias. We all have bias. We all categorize people. We try to make understanding of our world by making snap judgments. No one is exempt. So I, as a black man in these yet to be United States of America, continue to do work to understand my bias, to get curious about people, and to refrain from telling myself single story narratives about who people are, how they show up, why they believe what they believe. Right? So to that, and I don't want to get too far off track. I'll tell you this quick story. One of my closest friends was a Trump supporter. We're like, cool. I just talked to him yesterday. Do we see eye to eye on everything? Absolutely not. Have we gotten into arguments about things? Yes. To the point where we have had to like stop talking and pick up at another time. But what he's allowed me to see in our proximity is it's not a single story narrative. Not everybody who votes for Trump is some racist. There are actually people who voted this way because of an indoctrination or a belief, or believing that they have to vote this way because that's the single narrative that they have about voting the other way. And so there's a bunch of different things at play. And so it gives you entree into the nuance of where people land and why they land there. And I wish that we would, to the point of your platform and what you're doing here, I wish we would get curious about one another again and not operate with those snap judgments that then label, because what you can label, you can ostracize. What you ostracize, you can vilify. And then what you vilify, you then create laws and justify your stances.
I completely agree on the biases front.
Yeah.
And they're continually popping up in my life. And yeah. One time I had gone to a anti-bias training at work. And a guy who is from a minority group stood up in front of this whole group and he's like, I don't have any biases. I'm like, everybody kind of shook their head and go, well, if you're human, you're going to have biases just by virtue of you being a human. So welcome to the condition. Let's recognize it. We got them. Now, what do we do with them? And what do we do with them when they crop up or they show their head? Yes, I've gotten over being surprised where my biases show up, because they'll pop up all over the place, and it becomes kind of a investigative whack-a-mole through any particular day where it's like, oh, look, there it is. Well, I'll be, or something happens, a thought goes through my head and I'm like, oh yeah, look at the dark side of where you're going to with that. Why are you going there?
Yeah.
They are continually a part of us, which, as you stated, it's a survival thing. It's supposed to. We need to figure out who's friend and enemy, what's food, what's not. All of those things are appropriate and healthy. Yep. It's just we're in a little bit different world than we were lots of years ago, where that rattle in the bush is a tiger or a bunny rabbit.
Right. And when our biases pop up, we have to do a better job of, one, recognizing that it's common ground for everybody, and then, two, not go into the dangerous extremes. Because in one sense, if it pops up, it's an indicator that there's work to be done and questions to ask of ourselves. But it's also like you can deal with it by asking questions and processing and hopefully doing that in community. And let me be clear here. When I say community, I mean when I'm willing to make your problem my problem, we're in community. When I'm willing to make your success my success, then we're truly in community. And so if you could do that with someone or persons, that helps, because we all have blind spots. The other side is, if you ignore them, it's like the folks that say, well, stop talking about racism and it'll go away. It's like the dumbest argument I've ever heard. Like, stop talking about the disease that is in your body and it'll stop, it'll cease to exist. That doesn't happen. You have to treat disease.
Right.
Right? Like, disease doesn't go away because you took a Tylenol. And that's what you're asking me to do. By not talking about something, you ask me to take a Tylenol for a headache, but I really have a viral infection and I need something more. I really have a bacterial infection. I need antibiotics. So you can either treat the symptoms by not talking about it, or you can treat the disease by getting your hands dirty a little bit. It's messy, but it's worth it. And so I hope that we don't fall into the dangerous extremes of, one, now that we've recognized it, on one side, it's you can recognize it, you can see it, you can ask questions of each other, but then you go into this dangerous extreme of seeing everybody that way and not allowing folks to tell you where they are on their journey, giving grace for people in the journey. If I'm on chapter 6 of the book, I can't be mad at you for being on chapter 1.
Amen.
I got to give you grace and space to get there. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if you're not willing to open the book, if you're not willing to read and engage and to have honest conversations, you know, that's the other dangerous extreme. And I think we miss each other in that process.
Certainly a possibility. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's jump in the Wayback Machine a second here. So were curiosity and questions a part of your childhood?
So I have a son, Shane, he's 12. He reminds me a lot of me. There's things that I probably forgot about myself in my adult life that he reminds me of. He's very, very inquisitive. He lives in his head a lot. And so when he comes and produces a question, that's because he's thought about it for a very long time and then he's coming to you with something that he's really, really thought through. That's how I used to be growing up. There was a sense in which questions and power affected one another. Here's what I mean. If I'm a child asking an adult a question, there's a certain section of questions that it better stay in because I'm a child and you got to stay in a child's place. You can't ask too many questions. You can't ask the wrong questions. and your questions better be framed in a way that shows that deference to those who are older, those who have been on the earth longer. And so I learned very quickly that there's only a certain section of the questions in my brain that I can actually get out to verbally ask others. So I had unanswered questions a lot in my childhood that I think kind of goes with some of the cultural norms in how I grew up and in some of the family backgrounds and the ways that people, you know, show up in our world. So were questions a part of my childhood? Absolutely. But they had to be curated.
I love the twist there. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And do the children in your life have free rein to ask you questions on anything and everything? Or is that not a safe space? And to consider what the world would be like if it was a safe space whereby we could all just explore our curiosity and what that would look like. It'd be different. Because to think for Bobby, you being able to ask those questions and to give your curiosity free rein, you probably would have understood the world a little bit better and found the edges of what those, you know, the parents or elders in the community and the family, right? All of that would be remarkable to know for you earlier on, especially when you're asking the questions, because you've already created the bin in your mind for an answer. And now, like, okay, that bin is sitting there waiting until what, you're now 10 years older that you're allowed to ask that question to fill that bin?
Not to go morbid here, but the reality is for me, when I got old enough to actually ask the questions, you know, I was raised primarily by my grandparents, and my grandfather passed away due to cancer when I was still in college. And my grandmother passed away, and just before she was going, she had experienced dementia. And so she wasn't the same person. And so asking those questions was not possible because we had spent so much time not asking them. And so I hope that the listeners who are tapping in would understand that children are by nature curious. They are by nature trying to understand their world. They are by nature going to ask questions. And what we do is we punish them for not asking the questions from our side of history. So we've been conditioned to ask questions a certain way, to ask them with a certain level of, I'm going to use the word seasoning, to make sure that it's packaged right for the person who hears it. Children will come up and be like, why do they look like that? Oh, you don't say that. You don't say it that way. But for me, that's a teachable moment.
Right.
What you're asking me is, what, like, you're noticing a difference here. Is that, am I hearing you right? That they're, you're noticing a difference? Yeah. Like, why is that different than how I normally see people? Oh, well, let me explain to you why that is. Let me show you how what you're asking can be heard differently than what you're intending. You're asking about difference, and there are differences all over. For example, literally, this happened to me a few years ago. I'm walking in BJ's. Where I'm at, BJ's is like a big wholesale club. So Sam's Club, Costco, BJ's, those are like big three. And I'm walking in BJ's, and a child who was with their parent in the cart makes a comment about my skin color. The mom immediately shushes the child. Immediately.
Mm.
The child didn't mean any harm. They're noticing a difference. So what if, and for the purposes of this story, it is important to mention that this is a white family.
Okay.
Because what if we replayed that and the mother said, isn't his skin beautiful? This is what happens when you have more melanin in your skin. It comes out this way, and it shows the just how different we can be, but we're all humans, and this is what this means, and this is the beauty of how we all show up in the world. What if that curiosity that the child had was used as a launching point to talk about the beauty in our differences rather than shushing? Because what she did was teach that child, we don't talk about race. We don't talk about skin color. We don't talk about difference. We pretend it doesn't exist. And then those children who pretend it doesn't exist become the adults that tell you if you don't talk about race, it goes away. No, let's get curious about it.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about it. It's beautiful. It's expansive. Let's do that in a way that makes sense for everybody.
Beautiful. Shifting to probably, I don't know, maybe it's the same time. When did you first understand the power of questions?
I feel like it's kind of been a theme all through my life. I think, you know, we talked about what it was like growing up with questions. I think in school, there's a certain level of, if you answer the right questions, then you get noticed in terms of your intellect and how you show up, that people see you as smart because you've answered certain questions in a certain way. I learned very quickly that, for example, I enjoy history now. In school, I hated history. Oh, I hated it. It was the worst because all it was is regurgitation of facts. You wanted me to study dates, times, and people, and then tell you, this is what happened in these dates, times, and these persons. It was never about the situational context in which people found themselves in. Like, I was taught Lincoln freed the slaves, literally taught this.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I found out that it wasn't that he was necessarily like the great emancipator that I thought he was. It was that he was trying to keep the Union together, and he was willing to do whatever it took to keep the Union together. And this was his only path forward. Literally quoted as saying, if I have to free the slaves to keep the Union, I'll do that. But if I have to keep slavery to keep the Union, I'll do that as well. And I'm like, oh, so it wasn't the story that I heard in school. It makes me think of a question that I asked one time in class. I was in Mr. Terrigan's class. I was I believe a sophomore. Mr. Terrigan was the sophomore or junior. I think it was a junior because I was up on the top floor. I think only juniors and seniors went up there. So I was on the top floor of my high school. I was in Mr. Terrigan's class, and we were going over Revolutionary War. And as I was talking to him about the Revolutionary War, I asked this question because it was the first time that I could remember. Wait a minute. there's this black guy on the page. And the first time that I see this black guy, he's getting shot. Crispus Attucks. I was supposed to remember his name. But the only thing I could see was that he was the victim of violence. And I asked, why is it that when I see me in a book, there's some violence or something wrong happening, or that they had to endure something? Like, why do I always see me in the book with suffering? And I don't think he really had an answer to that question. I know it's a hard question to answer now looking back, right? But because it kind of flips things on its head. But what I was asking in that question was, why wasn't there better representation? And he couldn't answer that question because that's a systems level question. And he was just doing what he was taught to do, which was to teach the curriculum. Right. And so your question about when did I realize the power of questions? I think the power of questions was reaffirmed to me by folks either being willing or not willing to answer them. Because I would ask tough questions, I think, all through my life. And when folks didn't want to answer the question, or they didn't have an answer to the question, it let me know, you know, just how powerful questions can be, because they, if asked the right way, it's invitational in its approach. Mm. Like, I would rather invite you to a table of dialogue than to be combative and have to work all through and shoot down all the arguments for it, like that inner lawyer that we all have that rises up to our defense. Rather than you summoning your inner lawyer, I'd rather ask some questions that invite you into and get curious about the answers that you give me, because I found greater success in asking better questions of people than to shoot down their arguments and shout in my silos. So when I was on Instagram before I left, I would even engage with certain trolls. They'd say something and I'd ask a question back. Why do you think that? Because sooner or later, you're going to have to reveal where the root of that thought comes from. Hmm. And at that point, we can then have a dialogue about that. So I think the power of questions was kind of reaffirmed through my life through people's willingness or unwillingness to engage with them.
How did that express itself with students and parents?
Yeah. So knowing that I could not ask certain questions that I learned very quickly not to ask them, it put me on a path to where I wanted to ensure that my students felt safe enough to ask them of me. That when they say certain things that may not be polished or clean or however you want to say that, I'll answer the question and then we can engage on the how they ask that question and how that can be interpreted, and we can clean it up, but ask it. I think that sometimes the questions that students ask will show you, will sometimes reveal to you what they've been exposed to, where their mindsets might be, and it gives you clues into how to better serve them as people. So I always want to be that space, that brave space where you can ask the question unfiltered and then we can clean it up. When it comes to parents, I think questions have been the impetus for me wanting to lead with levels of transparency. So what I mean is, as an educator, I am a public servant. Parents are entrusting me with the best that they have, which is their kid. It is my responsibility to educate and empower this child towards their best self. They're trusting me with that. So when it comes to things that we have to report on, whether that be instances of bullying, whether that be our academic success or failure, I want to be transparent about that because our parents are trusting us to do the best we can with the best that they have, right? Yep. And so I go above and beyond to try to explain what these numbers mean. You're going to get these numbers on an assessment. What does it really mean? Why does it matter? Right? Parents are looking at, did you get an A, a B, or a C? And sometimes that A, that B, or a C can be misleading. Does your kid really know, have mastery over this standard? Can they operate with this skill in the real world that is something that is transferable, is needed? Do they know how to do this thing? I have to have real conversations with parents about that. Sometimes it means taking off my administrator hat and saying to a parent, you want to ask this when you go to the meeting. Make sure you ask this question of the teacher. Make sure you ask this question of the school. Make sure you ask these questions to better serve your student, your child. Here's where your rights come in. Like, I've had to have those conversations because being a public servant and serving students sometimes means that, like, if you are conditioned to put the institution of your school above and beyond the person that you serve, then sometimes you're going to make compromising choices that put them in risk. I'm just not willing to do that. So sometimes I have to say, listen, here's what you want to ask. Here's the question that you're not asking.
Yeah.
And you need to ask it. And so transparency on the parent side and a brave space for the students, if that makes sense.
It does. I appreciate your intentionality in creating a safe space, because when I was coming up, it was a different world.
Yeah.
Growing up in Northern Arizona. Yeah. A different world than many other parts of the country. So intentionally creating a safe space so these conversations can be had, and allowing the students to ask the questions poorly or to give that super rough draft,
yeah.
Help them clean it up and go, okay, this is beautiful, because that's teaching in and of itself and helping them on, you know, it's hitting several different levels for them. And then over on the parent side, are there standard questions that parents should be asking? Because no doubt it's very specific for their student going into a particular school. But for parents, are there categories of questions or examples of questions that should be planning on asking? What are those key questions that parents ought to be asking?
If you're a parent and you want to get an idea of how leadership deals with, for example, difference, it's a big question. How can people who are different than you show up and be their authentic selves here? I would literally ask this on interviews. If I go on an interview for a job, I ask this question, and I think parents should ask this question of leadership. Tell me who is most different on your team than you, and tell me about how you make that work in your leadership. One, there has to be a level of empathy, proximity, and understanding, and even for them to tell you who's most different and why they are. And then two, there has to be systems, policies, or practices that support that difference for them to tell you how they work together. So I would ask that question, because if they allow leadership to be different, then surely there's a better chance that they're allowing your child to be different as well. Power dynamics beat students into conformity. So if you don't show up how I'm asking you to show up, then there is a rule, a practice, a law, an understanding that would demand that your students show up this way, right? And so we need to ask better questions of difference and how we deal with difference. That's one question I would say to ask. I would ask them, but depending on where you're coming from, if the concern is more so on behavioral side and consequences and things, I would ask them, when was the last review that they've had of their code of conduct policy? And is it consistent with the students that they have currently, or consistent with when it was first established? The reason I ask that question is we have code of conduct policies that their last review was 6-7 years ago. And if you were to interrogate the code of conduct policies and dress codes and things like that, a lot of times they have things written in them that are culturally biased, that affect a particular group of people, particularly our Black young ladies in school. And so I'd ask them, when's the last time they reviewed it, to see what they said and what were the results of that review. If you're asking questions with regard to their academics, I would ask them about a teacher who needed instructional improvement. They don't have to say names, but tell me about a time when a teacher on your staff needed instructional improvement and how you supported them. Why do you want to ask that question? You want to ask that question because we are in a time now where, in a lot of districts, a warm body in a classroom is better than nobody in the classroom with our teacher shortage. And you want to know if they are still holding some level of instructional excellence or standard in their classroom. And so Tell me about a time when this happened. How long ago was that? And what do you do to support teachers who don't meet that mark? How do you ensure there is instructional excellence in your classroom? What I find is in the work that I get to do, not just as a school leader, but with Liberation Lab, I find that the behaviors in your school are sometimes a result of one, instructional gaps that need to be filled, and then two, practices and policies that are punitive more than they are restorative. And so then it becomes this vicious cycle of things. So by you asking that question, you get to one side of that. And then by you asking the code of conduct, you get to the other side. How are they handling their code of conduct? Is it commensurate with the group of people that they have in front of them now? Or is it just some outdated thing that they just keep doing? That's one. Two, how do they handle the instructional side of things, and how do they coach towards that academic excellence that you expect? And then lastly, I would say anytime that you are a parent coming into a parent-teacher conference and you are looking at a grade, they're doing well, they have an A in the class. What does that A mean? Truly. For example, because of the ways that grades are weighted in school, I could not do my homework, do the classwork, ace the test, and still get an A. So I can pick and choose what I really want to do based on how assignments are weighted in the grade book. And I understand why they do it. As a parent, what you want to know is, there are any gaps in my child's learning? And what are you doing as a teacher to help that gap? And what could I be doing to support at home so that we can fill these gaps?
Right.
How can we work together to fill any instructional gaps along my child's education? So even if your child has an A in the class, don't assume that an A means that they've got it all, because they do not. An A means that they might have done it really, really well, and there still might be gaps to fill. So you always want to ask about those as well.
That's beautiful insight. Thank you. Appreciate the concrete examples as well, because it's be helpful for folks to jot down and carry with them as they head in.
Absolutely.
How can we foster equity and justice in the classroom?
We first have to understand what that means, right? Equity is a buzzword now in education. It's a kind of a buzzword in our world. So everybody's saying it, but not everybody has the lens for it. I've even heard Ron DeSantis get up on stage and talk about it. And he said that Republicans need to be the party of being colorblind. And I cringed. It was terrible. I understand what he's trying to communicate there, because there's an ideology at work. However, if you are colorblind, that means you're treating everybody the same. And you don't need to treat everybody the same. You need to give people the supports that are indicative of where they are. I saw this cartoon satire, and it's talking about the educational system. And in the picture, there is a chimpanzee, a fish, an elephant, a snake. And it said, your test will be go climb that tree. And when you get to the top, you get an A. Well, the genius of the elephant is not going to be indicative of whether or not it can climb the tree. The genius of the fish will not be indicative of whether or not it can climb the tree. Matter of fact, to use the fish as an analogy, if I take that fish out of water and I put it on land, it's going to look like it does not function well, that something is wrong with it. But if I take that same fish and I drop it in water, you begin to see the genius of the fish come alive and do things that I could never do. Sometimes it's about putting our students in the environments that best see their genius. So when it comes to fostering equity, the analogy I like to give is every school district got COVID money to be able to foster online instruction. They got every student a Chromebook, a device. That was equality. Everybody got the same thing. What they failed to ask was, do you have adequate Wi-Fi at your home? Do you have a place to work quietly at your home? Do you have a space to sharpen your pencils, to do different? No, we assume that all these things were there. But when I start asking questions about what you need in particular, that's equity. Equity is giving the supports where needed to each child. Speaking of the academic equity.
Mm-hmm.
And so supporting that means, one, we have to do work in ourselves. It starts with self. You have to do work in deconstructing and attacking and being curious about your own bias. Because in your bias, you start telling yourself single story narratives of the people that you teach. Well, if I have student A that didn't turn in an assignment and student B that didn't turn in an assignment, and I say to them, well, now because your assignment's late, it's going to be 10 points off every single day. Well, student A didn't turn it in because let's say student A just didn't care about the assignment, didn't do it. But let's say student B goes home every single day and has to take care of three younger brothers. Their parent doesn't get home till 8 o'clock. They have to care for their family, cook dinner, and do all these different things. They're getting training in responsibility that no child should have to, but they are. But now I'm grading based off of that, and now I'm grading for privilege. You don't have the privilege to necessarily do those things and put them in on time, but you have mastery of a skill. If grades are about skill, then why am I grading the time in which it came in? Why? Like, we don't get curious enough about those things. Yeah. And so we do it this way because it's always been done this way. Does that mean it's right? And so academic and educational equity happens when we get curious about why we've always done things this way and who is it harming. We have to ask ourselves better questions. One, who is supported by this rule, practice, policy, or procedure? Who is left out by this rule, practice, policy, and procedure? Why are they left out by this rule, practice, policy, or procedure? And then four, how do I change this rule, practice, policy, or procedure to better support everyone in my learning community? It can be as simple as when students come to your classroom, a lot of teachers will say, these are my rules for the class. And then they get mad when a student doesn't follow that rule. Mm-hmm. But those are your rules. You came up with them. But what about classroom agreements? Hey, you know, we've all been in a class where it didn't work out the way we wanted it to. We wanted it to be fun and engaging. What made it that way? Students will tell you. Like, students are experts at telling you why they didn't like something. Use that to your advantage. Why didn't you like it? What happened? They'll tell you about the students in the class. They'll tell you about why they couldn't learn. They'll tell you about how the teacher showed up. You write all those things down and you begin to use that as a sounding board for now. Okay, well, what kind of agreements can we make to ensure that this space isn't what you experienced before?
Mm-hmm.
They come together. We make classroom agreements. We now agree together that this is what this class will look like. So now when a student does blow it, and their students, the kids, you know, I teach middle school. I still call them my babies. Yeah. My babies are going to blow it. Cool. It's not you broke my rule. It's, hey, man, we're a community here. Remember, we came up with these community agreements, and you're not living up to that right now. Here's what you agreed to do. You agreed to do this, 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 and this. Well, we didn't do that here. Who was harmed by that? The fact that you chose not to do it or show up in this way, or you chose to do this act, who was harmed? Well, I don't know. No, you do know. Let's think deeper. Who was harmed? Well, you, the teacher. Okay. Is there anybody else who witnessed what you did or what you said? Yeah, the class kind of heard that. Heard me chuckle and make that joke or disrupt the class this way. Do you think that only the student you said it about was hurt by it? No, probably her friends too. So how can we make that right? Well, I definitely, you know, maybe saying sorry. Okay, yeah, we could say sorry, but have you ever been mad still after somebody apologized for something to you? Like, when somebody apologizes to you, does it make it always right? No, it doesn't make it always right. Sometimes I'm still mad, okay? So even when you say sorry, know that that person still has the right to be upset at how you made them feel. What are some ways and some things that you can do moving forward so no one feels what you've allowed her or him to feel? Well, maybe I shouldn't allow that to happen. I shouldn't allow people to make jokes like that. Good. Let's see how that works. And let's check in a week and see how that's going. But now, it's not a write-up to the principal's office. It's not me kicking the kid out of class. It's not them losing instructional time. It's them caring about a class community because I've invited them in on the process. And so I think we do that by ensuring we have community agreements. We're looking not with a single narrative. I think from a systems level, we continue to set up schools like the old castles with the moats around them, with the drawbridge. We tell families, students, and their communities how they need to show up, when they can show up. And then if you show up the way that I've asked you to, well, then I will let down my drawbridge and you may approach.
Mm.
But what if we saw the community around our schools as a strength? What if there were ways that the community could teach us how to better serve? What if instead of asking families to come to the school all the time, we showed up where in their places of value, of their places of meeting spaces? What if I didn't have parent-teacher conferences or an event at the school, I instead had it at the community center where they're already showing up? What would that say and communicate to the community if I'm willing to show up on their terms? I think that sometimes we get locked into doing things a certain way because it's just been the way it's always done. Just because something has been done doesn't mean it can't be improved.
All right.
And so when we're willing to do that, I think we get to the heart of what it means to pursue equity for every student, because now we have proximity. Now we're meeting. Now we see the community. I always want to lead in such a way where I turn my critics into coaches. When I have a parent that is griping about everything that is happening, they're doing so from a place of care, even if I don't want to see it that way. Well, I want that person to come to my school and be a part of my parent advisory committee. Because now what if I get that parent on board? They see the effort that I'm making. They see the things that I'm trying to change. And now that parent goes back into the committee and says, you know what? I said exactly the same thing you said about this school. But come see the work that Mr. Morgan's doing, because he invited me in. He opened up and said, these are the things that I'm trying to change. What do you think about them? How can we make that better?
Wow.
And so we have to turn our critics into coaches. We have to be willing to examine our policies, practices, and procedures. And then we have to be willing to get into the stories and narratives of people to better support them in the journey. We do that, I think we're getting to the heart of equity, and we'll see the results of it.
It is a beautiful view and a beautiful practice as you put together. Because I heard folks asking the question about what are we really teaching in school? We need all these things to be a human, but in school we get all these facts and figures and that's what we learn. But your example is a perfect way to integrate teaching how to be a whole human and functioning within the community. You're getting that at school. Whereas if it's sit down, shut up, or just show up for half an hour after school and sit quietly in the corner and do your homework, it's not the engagement as a human that I need in teaching me the skill set that I need to go out and be able to engage with my coworkers when I'm 50. That, you know, by virtue of asking those questions and walking those students through that kind of practice gives them some of those tools to be able to do that.
Absolutely. And what better place to do that than at school? Like, where they're learning and growing and making mistakes, failing forward. What better place?
So how you just threw that out, I love that from the standpoint that it challenges my view. All these things need to be taught in the home because of the burden on the school system is so extreme and there's so many different dynamics going on. But by virtue of you just tossing that out of saying it's a golden opportunity because that's where they are experiencing life and failing and succeeding, that it is a golden opportunity. And therefore, if we're not doing it, then it's a missed opportunity.
Absolutely. And I think you hold those two truths in tension. Should it be happening at home? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be happening at school. And one of my favorite movies is Mulan. It's one of my favorite movies.
I hear you mention it often, so yes.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. For those who may not have heard the analogy, I think it's important to say that she's given this task of being a man. It's a play on sexism and misogyny. And in the movie, she's dressed up as Ping, this man in this army. And every person is being tasked to climb this pole and get this arrow that's at the top of this pole. And they have these weights they got to carry. And she was the only one smart enough to recognize if she took those weights, threw them around the pole, that they could be used as a counterbalance to propel her to her purpose, to get to the arrow that was at the top. Well, what if we hold the tension of this should be happening at home? Parents should be giving the space to fail forward and ask better questions and to grow in their full humanity. And it should be supported at school, and kids should be given grace and space to be able to make those mistakes and to talk through things. And we shouldn't be on kids about how they asked the question, but whether or not they asked it, and then we could clean it up later, all of those things. And we wrap it around the pole of education. And now kids are beginning to propel towards their purpose. They're ascending to the heights that they probably could if we created that space. Well, if we do that, then man, it's so much better than what we have presently, because what we have presently is all about conformity and compliance and control. And then they get out in a world where people are being asked to be creative and collaborative and spontaneous and to think outside the box. Well, you just told me for the last 18 years to be compliant.
The most formative years.
Yeah. But now I'm supposed to produce something that's groundbreaking, that actually helps. I don't know how to do that because I was never trained for that. Well, maybe we should do something better in school.
You stated, you can't teach what you refuse to see. I read that on the internet, so it may be wrong, but you can validate that one way or the other. So can you expand on this thought?
Yeah, I'll go back to my story of that young man, Thomas. I wasn't teaching Thomas. Thomas was one of the students in the class, and if you have a headache, you take Tylenol, even if the headache might be some symptom of a different type of, I'm going to say, disease or cause, right? I don't know what the cause is. It could be that I didn't drink enough water that day. It could be that I'm actually struggling with some type of infection. It could be that I hit my head and now I have a headache. I don't know, but the symptom is a headache. Well, if I treat every single one of those examples with Tylenol, then I'm never really meeting the true need.
Yeah.
So you can't teach or help or serve what you refuse to see. I said this before the recording, but I'll say it here. I think our inability to ask better questions of each other, to build proximity, is the reason why we went from larger porches and shorter fences to taller fences and smaller porches. We don't have places of meeting anymore where we can truly see each other. Because if I truly see you, then I can teach you, then I can help you, then I can support you. Because you're no longer one of a number, a data point, a vote, and the list goes on. You're a person. I see you in your full humanity. So for me, I did not meet Thomas where he was at because I thought I already had the answer. The answer was, you're going to do it because I'm the teacher and you're the student and you're going to stay in a child's place. That child has to go home and experience being home alone for hours because his mom is working. He has to cook for himself. He has to clean for himself. And he has to do all of these things that we don't ask an average 12-year-old to do. Doesn't mean that students, he's not learning or growing up. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying he's helpless. I'm saying that he has to do these things for his survival. Hmm. So I'm saying, I'm not truly seeing that student anymore because I didn't see his story, his narrative, what he's experiencing, and how he shows up. So maybe that young man could have been better served with, and then, you know, I know there's so much on your plate. And so when you come here, this just seems like another thing. But what if I told you that this example, this thing that we're doing right now, is going to put you in a better position to make the money that you want to make in the world, to better support your family? What if this little task right here is serving such a better purpose? Would you be willing to allow me to show you how that works? Well, now I've asked a question. It's invitational. It's not combative. I've disarmed and brought down the conversation. And now we can engage in the way that shows his humanity and mine. Mm. We won't teach who we don't see. And when you truly see people for who they are and how they show up, man, what a better world we can live in.
Yes. Applies to the classroom, the bedroom, the boardroom.
Boardroom.
Right.
Yeah.
All of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what kind of things go through your mind when the kids are not asking questions?
Who silenced you? Who told you that your voice doesn't belong here? I had a student, her name was Hazel. Hazel is just a wonderful, spirited child. I was teaching middle school in Trenton at the time, and she was getting herself into trouble because when she felt triggered or hurt, she got loud, perceived as loud. She got perceived as disrespectful. Mm. But what I saw in Hazel was a young lady who wasn't going to allow others to silence her. She just needed a different way to communicate. So when I sat down with her, I would ask her questions. Even when we got into it, I said, what are you trying to tell me right now? And she would say, I'm trying to say that you're not listening to me. Okay. When you raise your voice, do you think I hear you better? Like, is that what that is? No, but it's the only way I can get you to listen because you're not hearing me when I talk regularly. Noted. How can I do a better job of listening to you when you're talking? How do you pick up on whether or not I'm listening? Well, now what I've done is I've invited her into a process of dialogue with me. And she's taught me something about myself in the process for how she perceives me, whether it's intended or not. We do this thing all the time in our world where we say, well, my intentions were pure. Intentions be damned. It's always impact over intention. What was the impact of what you did? And you could have the best of intentions, but you could still cause the most damage ever. There was a young man, I believe, who was wrestling. And he had locks in his hair. And as he's wrestling, they said that he couldn't have those locks. And they cut his hair. The intention was for him to compete. But do you understand the damage that that might have caused for that child? Because he couldn't show up with his natural hair, right? So going back to Hazel, she, in certain classes, would not show up as herself. She was silent. And because she was silent, some teachers thought that she was, oh, she's better in class now. Is she really?
Mm.
Is she really better in class? Or is it just better for you? Is it more convenient for you? Can you just get through your lesson now? Because again, it's about the production. The education is very transactional. And so because it's transactional, you feel less successful because you can get through some things now. You can get to certain parts of your lesson without a hiccup. But have you checked her pulse? Is she alive in your class? Does she feel valued, seen, supported? Does she feel like she belongs, like she's supposed to be here? Because ultimately, you don't have a classroom without students. Educators should do well to remember that. They are the center of what we do. And if they are the center of what we do, then we should ask better questions that center them in our practices. And so Hazel taught me a lot. She was silenced. She did not show up as herself. By asking better questions, we could then get to the how. Because then I was able to tell her, now that we've built that level of trust, this is how others are hearing you. And I know that's not your intention. And I know that has to do with them more than you. This is how you can say exactly what you're trying to say so they will hear what you're trying to say. Can we work on that together? Yeah, we can do that. And it worked out for her. So when a child is silent, when a child doesn't show up and ask those questions, it's typically because we've conditioned them to do so.
It seems as though a lot of your work really highlights the systems that are in place and how we condition. Conditioning shows up often. And it's probably something the greater community needs to look at, is to say, what are those conditions that we have established for someone to show up? Because as much as we think it's going to be providing success or the result that we want, to your point, no, maybe it's not. And especially once they graduate and we're asking for creativity, and it's like, no, you taught me how to shut all that down. So at best, how this is going to show up is it's not going to show up in the workplace. It may show up in my creativity at home on my hobby. At some point, it may emerge, but otherwise, I can't show up as my full self.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, think about like creative writing. We're taught to look for intelligence in certain ways. So when someone thinks of something outside the box, we don't know how to measure that. We don't have quantifiable lenses for that level of intelligence, but we appreciate it when it's in a book. You know, behind me, over my right shoulder, for those who are listening, is a picture of James Baldwin, my favorite author. He writes, and I've always said this, he shows up, whether it's a speech or his poems or stories, he shows up as both alarm clock and eyeglasses to wake people up to a certain thing that he's trying to get them to see. And then the eyeglasses serve as a corrective way of seeing something that they might have overlooked. And he has a way of doing that. So in The Fire Next Time, for example, as he begins a letter talking to his nephew and talking to him about all the things that he experienced, and he talks about recounts his history with the church and how he and his father were combative and how he had to leave and all of these things, there is this thread of seeing it clearly, waking up yourself to something, and then now how do you see that as a result? The point I'm trying to make is this. We will see that as a classic now, as a literary work now. But what about the James Baldwins in your classroom, whose genius could be seen if we would allow them the creative license to think outside of the box? How can we create space for that? So yes, we do have to do the things, right? Like, I'm not saying that. We have to write these six paragraphs. We have to do these things, do them. We have to measure them that way. I'm not saying that that's part of the job. But how can we create space for the creative genius of someone like that to then express themselves? So if they're doing an argumentative essay and they are talking about a certain task, a certain injustice in their world, well, maybe the follow-up is, let's now create poetry that gets us into the emotional context of that thing that you researched. But we could create little spaces where that's possible. So now the creative genius of this child isn't relegated to when they're 20 and then they have to rediscover themselves because we beat it out of them, you know, from K to 12. We've created space for them to be creative, to be themselves, and to show up outside of those normative ways of being in school.
What comes to mind as you talk through, the days we're living in are so tumultuous and we have no idea what's ahead of us with, you know, the rise of AI. But the world is going to be so far different. So if we're shutting down the James Baldwins of today in the classroom, they're going to be our saviors in the days to come because they can see the world in ways that are far different than the molds that we built 60, 80, 100 years ago that we think are providing success today. And we need that creativity. We need those new ways of thinking so we are nimble to be able to succeed as a collective humanity, not just as an individual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The point about AI is important too, because school districts have a way of banning what they don't understand or what they don't want to deal with. And whether or not you know it, that child has recognized that they can go to ChatGPT and tell ChatGPT to write a six-paragraph essay on this topic with these points answering this question. And they know the next site that they can go to and put that text in will unwrite the code that allows you to pick up on whether or not they got it from ChatGPT. They know this. So what if in your classroom you decided to say, we're going to write an argumentative essay. I want you to come up with your best points. We're going to put them in these sections on this Google Doc. Now I want you to take your points, copy them, and now I want you to go to ChatGPT, and I want you to ask ChatGPT to come up with counterpoints to your argument. So now you're better informed on how to craft your essay. I now want you to come back and you research how you could come up with an argument to ChatGPT's points to you. Man, what would that do? In shaping the next wave of thinkers by using AI to craft a better argument, to push human knowledge and thinking in a way that says, oh, I didn't think about that kind of point, but now that you said it, here's my argument for you. What if we had them write letters to their local council members or political offices regarding some injustices that they see? And before they do that, tell ChatGPT to act as a local councilman, act as a state legislator or a state assemblyman. And I want you to tell me, with all the pressures of your job, what your reservations would be to this request that I'm making in my letter. How do you see that? ChatGPT comes up with an argument, and now you include that. I know you're going to say that you don't have time because of this, 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 and this. But what happens if you don't act today? Now they've formed something deep and critical, and they've used AI to better shape their thoughts versus you telling them not to do it. Anytime you tell a kid not to do something, what is that thing that they're going to do?
That's what we got to go do.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Absolutely.
Regardless of kids, you tell me I can't do it.
That's what I'm going to do. Absolutely.
Have there been any times where you've been scared to ask questions? You may cover some of that a little bit in the early years, but more looking older.
Yeah, I'm getting to a point now where, so I'm in therapy, recommend that to anybody who's listening. Mm. And I'm recognizing my inability to ask myself questions of why I think or act a certain way or respond a certain way. I'm noticing that sometimes in my life, I've avoided parts of myself and just continue to function in ways that are deemed acceptable and right and true and affirming in the world. And I refuse to have asked myself questions about where that might be. And so for me, I'm learning to ask myself better questions about who I am outside of, you know, what I'm going to say is the applause or the affirmation of people. Who am I? What makes me tick? And listen, at the end of that, I might find that I am very much still the same person, but I'm willing to ask the question now that I don't think I was willing to ask before.
Hmm. Yeah. Those are some of those questions for myself, same scenario, where I've come through a lot and a lot of growth in the last few years. And yet I still know that there's some third rail questions for me that continue to sit there. And scared to fully engage because I know I may not like the answers, and it just can be very challenging. So they continue to sit waiting for me, not so much like the evil angel on the shoulder, but just patiently waiting.
Yeah. And I think when you do that, there's healing on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Certainly through what I've been doing the last few years, there has been immense healing, but it's for a sickness that I didn't know that I had. And particularly about understanding our country, its history, how it affects my brothers and sisters that I'm walking down the street with. I was living in a world where I thought all of this stuff was true. And then find out, no, that's not the case. And living in light of truth is so far better. So yes, as I engage some of these other questions, it'll be, okay, but let's resolve some of these and resolve it for today. Does your family encounter your curiosity and questions, or is this just something that's work-based, or do your wife and kids get a chance to encounter all of your questions?
More than not, my wife is my best friend. She's taught me to be okay with the messiness of questions as they come up and not be so polished. I think even though we've had similar experiences in our history, she has resolved to be a little less filtered in a healthy way. Like, be okay with the messiness because she's comfortable with herself. And I've resolved to be, and I'm working on it, to present more polished and put together so that you'll hear me or so that you'll see me. And I'm learning to be okay with the messiness and to be a little less filtered, curated, if you will. And she's learning that sometimes the tension of being polished or refined will help with how people perceive and see and respond to you. And so we kind of help balance each other out.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
When you think about questions, do you spend any time crafting questions if you're going to be going in to talk to a student or parents or a circumstance? Do you spend time thinking about that intentionally, or is it more you kind of trust on things happening or emerging at the right time?
I definitely operate more out of trusting that it'll be right at the right time. Mm-hmm. I think experiences, you know, have kind of taught me to go in and investigate by asking questions about where they are and then allowing that journey of those questions to materialize and then kind of point me in the right direction.
Okay.
Right. To not go on with a preconceived notion of what things are so I can just get to the result, but to ask, okay, well, what are you experiencing right now? Have you been helped? What could I do to better support you and your child? Things like that just kind of help navigate the process for me and point me in the right direction. It's a better compass than me coming in thinking that I know.
Gotcha. So yeah. Along those lines, are there any particular favorite questions that you have to open things up or break through anything?
I think one of the things that I try to do is say, especially, I don't care if it's any type of dissatisfaction or anger or animus or anything like that, or if there's even a misunderstanding of what I am able to do in the given position, I will say, if we switched places right now and you were in my seat, what would you do differently? Or what would you want to be done? Typically, it tells you where the pain points are before you can even articulate them for yourselves. And then from that space, I'll say, I think I understand where you're coming from and why you say that. I think we're after the same goal, and here's why I'm doing things this way. Here's the legislation that might prevent me from doing this thing that you're saying, and here's why I have to do it this way. Or the hard part about what you're saying is I'm not just a principal for your student. I'm a principal for every student, and I can't just make this one decision that favors your child above this, or it has to be a fair and equitable process. So if you give me just a little bit of grace, I understand where you're coming from. At the end of this, I know that you will feel supported. Can you trust me in the process? And if it doesn't, we can come back to it and revisit it. Is that all right? And more times than not, I get people on board by asking them, if we traded places, what would you do differently? Hmm.
Wonderful. Yeah. Let's shift to your work with the Liberation Lab and the work that you're doing on that front. Can you talk us through what the project is and the change that you're seeking to make?
When I first came into education, I had high control methods, really valued compliance over everything else. And it really wasn't serving me or my students. And I think that's the default mode of our education system. It is the default mode of education, and silent compliance students will exhaust both teachers, educators, and students. It will exhaust us all if we allow it. And so what we have to do, the choice we have to make, is to disrupt the normal system. How do we do that? Well, for me, I think that sometimes folks, when they get into service spaces, they want to do all the things. They see all the gaping holes and they want to plug them all. And as I began to fine tune and kind of find my voice and what I'm good at and what I believe will best serve, I knew that the areas I wanted to serve in is how we best relate to students when they blow it. What are our code of conduct and our policies created to do? When a student does not understand math, we will do a formative assessment, we'll do an exit ticket, we'll see where they got it wrong, and we will reteach the lesson. Student doesn't understand how to write, we will go over the mechanics, the flow, we'll reteach it, we'll show them an exemplar, we'll do it again. But when a student does not behave, we punish, and we expect that to teach them. For me, I knew I needed a different approach when I was growing up, and I would have loved to have been in a restorative school that would have given me grace and space to talk about what was affecting me and how best to interact with others in a way that's healthy, right, and true. So I try to create that through restorative practices. And then culturally responsive teaching for me is about an asset-based approach to learning and teaching. Your students in your school are bringing their strengths to you. Do not go on autopilot when you drive to your school. Look at the neighborhood in which they live. Look at the cultural artifacts that you see, their places of meeting, the conditions that they find themselves. That did not happen on accident. Everything very much is intentional. When you take all that in, it becomes an asset that you can use in how you instruct and how you see them. So culturally responsive teaching helps to remove the barriers of that students show up with, right? That education kind of puts on students to be able to engage them in a way that pushes the academic rigor and instruction of your classroom. So, for example, instead of it just being an argumentative essay with regard to a book that you had them read, perhaps the book brings up a connection to the real world that they live in. And now that argumentative essay is now a connection point to the world that they see and experience. And you use that to drive the rigor and instruction in your classroom. I think that helps a lot. And then obviously the last piece is the social justice education. That is that I want the classroom to serve as mirrors and windows. I want it to be a mirror where they can see themselves accurately, truly. But I also want it to serve as a window for where they can see their world for what it is, how it is, and how to best show up to serve so we can be our best selves, right, together, collectively. If we do those three things, I think we're doing a wonderful job in education. I think the rest takes care of itself. And so for me, those are the places where I felt like I can best serve education, best serve school leaders and teachers, and make the best impact possible. And so that's our goal, is to build disruptive educators through those three pillars.
Fantastic. And this is predominantly through the consulting that schools bring you in to do assessments and figure out plans towards that direction. Gotcha.
Yeah, absolutely. Primarily through schools. I've worked with nonprofits and businesses as well. I've helped with their planning and implementation. You know, when they go on planning retreats and things like that, those are always a joy to kind of help them come in with a lens to maximize their efforts. Work with schools and businesses to be able to achieve those types of goals. So at the intersection of culture, at the intersection of anti-racist work and things like that, you'll find me doing some work to try to help people move things forward.
Beautiful. And I know that you've got the podcast going on. I have to give a shout out to one of your recent podcasts with Keisha Garrison. So please, everyone, go check out his podcast. Please do that. I highly recommend number 19. And if you have no other time in the world, just go listen to the last 10 minutes of number 19, Dear Black Girl. That particular episode really meant a lot to me, just from the work, the growth that I've done in recent years.
Yeah.
I really point back to the work of Black women. Yeah. And so when Keisha did that last little bit of that episode, that resonated so deeply. In that caring for all the little Black girls out there and potentially some of the healing and encouragement that that may give. And I don't know if it exists or not, but I would love for this to exist in the world. It's basically 3 hours of predominantly Black voices, men and women, doing those little spiels for Black and brown girls, boys and girls, just because there's so much that are the other voices that are out there, not giving the encouragement. So yes, I am grateful for the work that you're doing. Like I said, listen to many of the episodes, but I definitely want to highlight number 19. That was remarkable.
I would say really quickly for those who are listening to your platform and your podcast, the labor of creating content and putting things out into the world for folks to look at, to examine, sometimes scrutinize, a lot of that stuff, you don't see the work behind the scenes and the connecting with others, the emails that need to happen, the creating of like the time and effort that it takes. So with one click of a button that says subscribe, you're doing a lot to help boost the reach of that labor, of that work. And so if you're listening here hit the subscribe button, hit the share button. It literally takes 5 seconds, but you're doing a world of good and helping to amplify the voices that you regularly glean information or be challenged by. So I just want to encourage your listeners, it's a small task that goes a long way. So don't just sit and consume, support by hitting subscribe, support by hitting the share button so that others can engage with it too.
I appreciate that encouragement. In your wildest dream, what is the impact you would like the Liberation Lab to achieve?
I say this all the time. I work to put myself out of business. While I enjoy the work that I get to do, I hope that our educational system, our places of work, our higher ed, wherever I get to go to speak or to consult, I want empathy, equity, compassion, all those things to live and breathe there, where you don't need me to come in to help you think through those things, to help build practices and policies and procedures around those things. They live there. My dream is that for every child, right? So when I say I'm centering Black children, it is because they are the most excluded in our world. And so by centering them, I'm really helping everybody. like the rising tide helps
Amen.
All boats.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so that doesn't mean, if anybody has that in their mind, that I'm trying to exclude white children. Absolutely not. Or Spanish children, or Filipino, Asian, South Asian, Pacific Island. It doesn't mean any of that. What I say is I center Black children, by extension brown, by extension white. Like, we are covering everybody, but by centering the needs of the most vulnerable, you then get a glimpse of what everyone else can be supported by. It's like the triage method. You don't go to the people who maybe have a cut on their arm first. You go to the people who need to be treated with the most intricate treatments possible, and then you work your way out. And so that's the work that I get to do when I show up to a school, when I show up to a business, when I show up to a college to speak or things like that, is I get to serve those folks. And then by extension, it serves everyone else. And so my goal, my radical dream, is that I'm not needed anymore, and that I can watch our babies thrive in spaces where they can show up and be their authentic selves.
Wonderful. Yeah, it would be amazing if the school systems in America reflected the care that you were talking through earlier, and that was just the normal practice. And yeah, those conversations are happening on a regular basis.
100%. 100%.
So do you have any other thoughts or encouragements on how questions can be used that we haven't touched on?
I just would reiterate, when your inner lawyer rises up and you want to get defensive, or you see somebody that's different than yourself, or something happens that you wouldn't normally do, someone else did something different, it causes some feeling in you, I want you to pause and get curious about why. I want you to do some real investigative work into where those feelings, thoughts, and emotions are coming from. If we can just do that, just that one thing, a world of difference can be had, because from us getting curious about it, from us investigating it, from us interrogating it, it might interrupt the biases that turn to policies, practices, procedures that harm others. If we can just get curious enough to ask ourselves why, I think we'd do a world of good in how we show up for others.
Appreciate that. It's always good to leave with some actions. So that's good. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
So where is the best place for folks to engage with you and learn more about what you're excited about?
Yeah, I would say you could visit me at my website, myliberationlab.com, myliberationlab.com. I'm on LinkedIn. If you search up Liberation Lab and my name, Bobby, it'll pull up. You know, what did Coach Prime say? Deion Sanderson, I'm not hard to find. and listen, I'm a whole human out here. Like, yes, there's a platform. Yes, I believe I'm doing some good work, but you have questions, you have a business or thing that you think I could help in, but you don't know if that's what I do, whatever it is, reach out to me. Like, I'm approachable. Send me a message. Send me a message on LinkedIn. Send me a message on TikTok. Send me a message at my website. Email me. However you best communicate, I'd be happy to serve, connect, and build with you. That's how I got here.
Absolutely. I was just going to echo that. Yes. Very, very approachable, very willing to engage. Very grateful for that.
Absolutely.
Cool. Absolutely. Bobby, thank you for sharing your experience and how questions have played such a key role in your life and career. Very, very grateful for your time and being a part of this conversation today.
Thank you for having me.
So for those who have joined us through the gift of technology, thank you for being here. Questions changed my life for the better. Bobby delivered insights into our world of education and offered questions that don't provide quick answers. This is where we get the chance to do our part and engage to find answers and ask more questions. Please take all you have learned here and be a light to those around you. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner, download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated, and appreciate Bobby mentioning that previously. This action ensures that we are engaging the questioning community. So until next time, keep questioning.